Hello, I'm Matt Baum, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On this week's episode, Soap, MASH, The Golden Girls, and Cheers. It's a little unfair that so many gay men adore The Golden Girls, but fewer have heard of the show Soap, without which Blanche, Rose, Sophia, and Dorothy wouldn't exist. It is also one of the most controversial sitcoms in television history, and I have a new YouTube video coming this weekend all about Soap's rocky road and why, for one summer in 1977, gay groups and conservatives both agreed that the show could never be allowed to air. For this week's episode of The Sewers of Paris, we're jumping back to a 2015 interview about Soap, which was something of an obsession for my guest Andrew. That's thanks in large part to the motherly love of the character of Jessica. Though her family was fractured and weird, her love never wavered. That family loyalty made such an impression on Andrew that he still thinks about and aspires to it to this day. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, don't forget to head over to mattbaum.com to subscribe to my newsletter and take a look at my YouTube channel for videos about film and TV history. My new video about the making of Soap debuts this Sunday, February 20th, kicking off with a live stream at 11 a.m. Pacific. And head over to my Patreon to support The Sewers of Paris and watch hours of bonus videos about queer pop culture. Now, here's my 2015 interview with Andrew. Andrew Blau, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So, Andrew, you work in entertainment. You are one of the most entertainment knowledgeable people that I think I know.
Thank you.
So I'm delighted that we're going to be talking today about something that I do not know a ton about, and that is the show Soap. Tell me about the show Soap. What is it?
The show Soap is a sitcom from the late 70s into the early 80s, created by Susan Harris, who is more famous, I would say, within the gay community for having created The Golden Girls. A show that I watched many years after it aired and many years after I'd already come to love Soap. And Soap is my one true love when it comes to Susan Harris's work.
So more than The Golden Girls, you say Soap is better?
Without question, which I'm sure is going to be very controversial. But The Golden Girls feels like a pale imitation of Soap to me. The things that made Golden Girls revolutionary or even just fun had already been done on Soap many years earlier, in a less forgiving TV climate. Soap seems to be both more revolutionary and far funnier. And it's more of a family dynamic rather than a friend dynamic, and I think as a child watching it, that appealed to me more than adult friendships did, for probably obvious reasons.
So what did they do? What was revolutionary?
They broke through every TV taboo and did it with humor. It was essentially a spoof on soap operas, but in doing so, they tackled every possible subject. Billy Crystal's character, Jody, was the first homosexual character in network primetime television.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Hi, big brother.
Hiya, little brother.
Why don't you offer him some Fruit Loops? It'd be very appropriate.
But they also talked about interracial marriage, and they talked about, well, sometimes absurd things like devil possession, but it just, no subject was sacred. One of the main plots of the season one was one of the daughters is in love with a priest, and their love affair causes him to leave the priesthood, which was an enormous scandal nationwide, and was one of the reasons why the show was both vilified and a cause célèbre when it debuted. There had already been months of protests. It was just an incredibly daring show, but it also was hysterically funny and, interestingly, very, very touching, which is, I think, why the show resonates with me to this day. There are many shows that are very, very funny, sitcoms, that is, but there are few that make you care as much as I did and still do about Soap.
So give me just the basic outline. What is the show about?
The show is basically about two adult sisters, Jessica Tate and Mary Campbell.
Jessica lives in a neighborhood known as Rich. The Tates have more secrets than they do money. We're approaching Mary Campbell's house. As you can see, the Campbells don't have nearly as much money as the Tates. They do, however, have as many secrets.
You know, it's a serialized sitcom about the lives and loves of these two eccentric, somewhat crazy families. There was an alien abduction. There were various brushes with death. There were various deaths as well. Jessica Tate died, I believe it was the end of season two, and was resurrected for season three. I think they probably took subject ideas from pop culture and famous movies and other television shows. I have to assume that Jodie's character was inspired by Lance Loud from An American Family. The Devil Possession obviously is a nod to The Exorcist, that sort of thing.
And American Family was a show on PBS a few years earlier.
Yes, revolutionary documentary, considered sort of the first reality television ever. A 12-hour or 12-episode serialized documentary just looking in depth into An American Family.
And Lance was, I mean, before even Billy Crystal played Jody, he was the gay son in that, like, reality show, what we'd call now a reality show.
I love to live, you know, with a style and a certain phony put-on elegance. Like, as Barry said, you know, I guess I want to be a superstar, but I really can't work for it. I really... You know, I have all these clothes, but I don't have the ideas behind them.
Right.
I'm trying to think if there's, like, before that, gay characters on television.
I mean, there were certainly silly-ass characters and feminized characters, but someone who identified as gay and who was a major character, I can't think of anybody who comes close those two.
Does Soap feel like, does it feel dated, or does it feel like a time capsule?
Yes, it does. As much as I love the show, I can't say that it's timeless. Jody's character has come under a great deal of criticism. He, as a gay man, slept with far more women over the course of the show than he did with men. His main story in the first season is that he is dating a professional football quarterback. Dennis, the character, can't obviously come out because football, the sports world, wouldn't have allowed it.
I mean, it's just too risky. You know, I've only got a couple of years of pro ball left. And after that, I've got to rely on making money from my endorsements. I mean, if people found out I was a...
Homosexual! All right, I'm sorry.
So Jody comes up with the idea that he's going to have a sex change so that they can still be together. And when Dennis rejects this idea and then breaks up with him, Jody is already in the hospital contemplating the sex change and decides to commit suicide in one of the show's, if not the show's, most resonant storyline. But then after that, he doesn't commit suicide. He ends up falling into bed with a couple of women and having relationships with women.
How come I'm humming and you're slamming things around?
You don't know? Because of last night, because of what I did last night.
Well, I did it too, but I'm not angry.
But I'm gay.
That's debatable.
And the show took a lot of heat, has taken a lot of heat with the gay community about that. And it's hard for me, because I want to defend the show completely. It is problematic. At the same time, I think the rules of sexuality and labels in sexuality were a little more fluid in the 70s than they are now. And the idea that a gay man could have relationships and sexual relationships with women wasn't as incredible then as it probably is now.
How did you watch it when it was originally on?
So I was probably 11 or 12, and I definitely discovered the show, probably because my parents were watching it, and I snuck into the room and realized that this was something funny and salacious and dangerous, and my parents watched it, so therefore I had to watch it. And so I don't remember at what point in the show I'd started. All I know, and I remember this incredibly vividly, the last episode in April of 1981 ends with my favorite character, Jessica Tate, in front of a firing squad.
Now, see, Sandy, I understand that sometimes when two groups don't believe the same way that this sort of thing can happen, and I do believe that you believe your intentions are just. Believe me, I admire anyone who believes in a cause. However, I don't believe that shooting one woman from Connecticut is going to help you.
Goodbye, Senora.
Good luck, Private.
Attention. Ready. Aim. Fire.
And I bawled, was absolutely sobbing, completely inconsolable, and soon thereafter wrote the creator, Susan Harris, a letter on graph paper, not sure why I remember that detail, on how to get all of the characters out of their cliffhanger situations, including how to save Jessica from certain death in the firing squad. I decided that everyone on the firing squad had fallen in love with Jessica and loaded their gun with blanks. So it was just the sound of guns going off, but no bullet actually entered her, and she was going to be fine. I don't think as a 12-year-old I understood that the show had been canceled. I certainly didn't know at the time the rumors that I've heard now over the years that Susan Harris had written an entire season of scripts in anticipation of coming back for the fifth season that never happened. At some point in my teens, I'm guessing around 15 or 16, I found the show again in reruns, so I was able to go back to the beginning of the show and watch all four seasons. And I think my sensibilities had certainly changed by then, and as an 11 and 12-year-old, the Jody character, while certainly a powerful character on the show, I don't think resonated with me in any personal way, because I think at that point I considered myself pre-gay, or didn't think about it at all. By my teens, I was aware of that. I was aware of my emergence as a sexual being, I guess is some weird way to refer to it. And I'm sure the character meant a great deal more to me in my teens than it did when I was 11 or 12. It felt this very forbidden, wonderful thing, this secret that I had somehow.
What was it about the show? What drew you in? What was so magnetic?
I think it has to boil down to the character of Jessica Tate, played so beautifully by Katherine Helmond. She was the ideal mother, which is funny because she was kind of daffy. I won't go so far as to call her stupid, but she was very daffy and a little naive. But she is unfailing in her devotion to her children, which was something that was just incredible to see. And I think that's what made the show so incredibly powerful for me, were these two mothers who really exhibited unconditional love for the most complicated and daffy characters. And that extends to, I'm sure as a teenager it resonated with me, that Mary's acceptance of her son, of her gay son Jody, which had a couple of bumps in the very beginning of the show, once those bumps are smoothed over, that love courses through the rest of the show. And that was an incredibly powerful thing to see as a child, as a teenager, and even as an adult, because I don't know how many of us have idealized mothers. My mother was great, but it was a different time in terms of parenting, and, you know, everyone makes their mistakes. Everyone could be better. Jessica, and to a slightly lesser extent Mary, were amazing mothers, and I think that meant a great deal, especially to a kid struggling with his sexuality in his teens.
Was that something you had a lot of anxiety about, was parental acceptance as you were coming out?
Sure. I think I had anxiety about parental acceptance for everything, but certainly coming out was a big deal. I mean, you know, I was coming out in the Midwest in the early 80s. I mean, it was a long process, but that's when it began. And there was no pop culture to guide me. There was no idea of a hotline, a support group, peers to talk to. So there was a lot of fear governing that whole process. And certainly the notion of telling my parents or sharing with my parents what I was going through didn't seem an option. They turned out to be pretty great in the long run once I did broach the subject with them. But, you know, I couldn't have been certain about that before I did actually speak to them. And I think shows like Soap, and there were very few like Soap, helped, you know, bolster my courage to tell them.
You know, it sounds like the characters on the show, like that Jessica and Mary have, of being these like just all loving mothers, like unconditional, no matter what happens, I'll look after my family, is sort of something that a lot of gay men seek out when we're creating our kind of our found family. You know, when we're going out into the world and finding the family that makes sense, you know, it's something that we need, particularly people who are rejected by their biological families.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I was in a world where I was never going to reject my family, nor have I. But, you know, as a single man now whose family is 2,000 miles away, I've certainly had to find my own family. And I think that, you know, shows like Soap helped give me structure to what that was going to be like. Certainly, if I have practiced some form of unconditional love with the various group of friends that I've made over the years and cherished and kept over the years, I certainly have no difficulty thanking Soap for that idea.
Give me some examples of the issues that Jessica and Mary faced and ways that they had to defend their families.
Where to begin? I mean, it's such a plot-heavy show that so much happens. I mean, in the first season alone, her daughter Corinne is the one who's in love with the priest, but she's also sleeping with the tennis coach that Jessica herself is having the affair with. And then the tennis coach is killed. So Corinne is sleeping with a priest. Her daughter Eunice is sleeping with a congressman who's married. And her son Billy is just a teenager and struggling and trying to figure life out. Her husband is cheating on her with absolutely everyone in sight. Her only real friend, besides her sister Mary, is the butler, Benson, incredibly played by Robert Guillaume.
Oh, for the dinner party tonight, I think I'd like for you to make beef Wellington.
Forget it.
Why?
I don't like it.
But it's very good. It's Mr. Tate's favorite.
It ain't mine. I don't like it, so I ain't making it.
On the other side, the Campbell family, Mary's son Danny is involved with the mob and is a thug and learns fairly early on in the first season that his stepfather, Bert, Mary's current husband, killed his father. Jody is gay and dealing with the quarterback and the desire to have a sex change. And then into their house comes Bert's son from another marriage, Chuck, who's a ventriloquist who goes everywhere with his ventriloquist dummy, Bob. And that's enough to start.
Soap opera stuff,
exactly. There was a big element of what the Golden Girls was in soap. One of my favorite scenes in all of television, let alone on soap, was tucked into the first, into the seventh episode of season two, where Jessica and Mary and Jessica's two daughters, Corinne and Eunice, sit around a table and basically discuss sex for 6 minutes.
You see, our mother never told us that it would be pleasant. No, what mother said was that it was required, like going to school had been, and that the best thing to do was close your eyes and make out your grocery list. And she also said that if you were really lucky, your husband would have a mistress, and then the mistress would get stuck with it.
It took you a long time to tell me that sex was nice.
That's because you knew before I did.
And so the idea that adult women could sit around a table eating baked goods and discussing sex had already been covered in 1978, when then it became commonplace for the Golden Girls to do it. The characters that really stick with me on soap are the women, far more than the men. One scene that gets to me, and I'm sure resonated with me as a child, even though my thoughts were never so dire, when Jody checks into the hospital in season one, his roommate is a man struggling with cancer. Jody is rejected by his quarterback, and he decides to commit suicide, and he steals a bunch of pills from the nurse's cart, and he's taken the pills, and he's slowly drifting off to eternal sleep. And Harold Gould knows something is wrong, though he doesn't know exactly how bad it is, starts telling this story, and tells this beautiful story about losing his first wife and how he thought life wasn't going to go on and the impossibility of love and how little by little and gradually he got up and days started getting a little better and a little sunnier and a little more manageable.
Listen, my kid. I know that you don't feel so terrific right now, but wait, Jody. Wait. Someday, I guarantee you, you're gonna hear somebody laughing. and you'll turn around, and it'll be you.
It's a scene like that that emboldens you to grasp onto the fact that maybe today's not so good, but tomorrow's going to be much better, and next week could be even better than that. It was something that I certainly lived by in the tougher times of my adolescence. Probably my favorite scene of all time, towards the end of the second season, Corinne has become pregnant, which is a mystery to her because at the time, her husband, the defrocked priest, has left her and gone to a retreat in the mountains, so she hasn't had sex in a while, and all of a sudden she's pregnant. The priest, of course, assumes that she's been unfaithful because she was a fairly loose woman before she committed to the priest, and doesn't believe her when she insists that there's no way she could have gotten pregnant. Well, the explanation is she gives birth to the devil.
He's possessed.
Oh, come on, Corinne.
No, he really is. He talks.
Talks?
Sentences.
There's a episode's long arc where the child is possessed by the devil, and the family is all up in arms and trying to figure out how to defeat the devil, and they bring in a priest who is defeated fairly quickly, and the Tim Flotsky, the priest, the baby's father, ostensible father, can't do anything. And the family gathers around the crib where the devil is grunting and leering and laughing, and Jessica has this monologue where she says, "This family has been through everything, but we're always together, and we will always stay together." And it rises to this crescendo, and she points at the crib and yells, "You have come to the wrong house!" And Jessica single-handedly exorcises the devil from her grandchild.
"We will fight you to the end. And let me tell you, we will fight! And with God's help, you will never have us! And you will never have this baby! Never! You have come to the wrong house."
And it's absurd and unbelievably touching.
But it's amazing. Like, imagine having someone like that looking out for your family and looking over your life.
No one's going to be possessed by the devil, I have to assume. But the idea that there are Jessica Tates in this world who will defend everyone, who just are nothing but loyal and will put their lives down for someone else, was and is just, it's a beautiful thing.
She's sort of an ideal mom in a very different way from June Cleaver. You know, you think of like ideal mom and the mom in a dress and the pearls who make the cake every day. And Jessica's situation is such the opposite of that, where everything is, it's either salacious or it needs to be swept under the rug in some way. But she's like, in that situation, she's the perfect mom.
And in that, I will say that resonates with my family life, because my mother was anything but the 50s ideal, and she'd be very happy to hear me say that. She was incredibly independent, incredibly left-leaning, just political, spoke her mind. And so Jessica did resonate with me on that level. She just felt real to me in a way that June Cleaver never, ever could.
Mm-hmm.
There's never a moment in the show's drama where members of the family reject each other. They can reject side characters and other things, but the family is fairly sacred.
So when you watch it, have you brought it to other people? Like, have you said to other folks, you need to see this and like watch it with people?
Oh, yes. I have spread the gospel as much as I can. Most recently, a friend of mine posted a blog entry about his 10 favorite sitcom episodes dealing with gay characters or gay themes or subjects. And Soap was nowhere on the list. And I said, this is absurd and offensive, and this is an utterly invalid list. And he said, well, I've simply never seen Soap. I said, well, get over here. And over the course of a number of weeks, we watched all four seasons of Soap. And it was great fun to watch it through new eyes. He sat there for four seasons with his mouth agape.
You know, we just, I think it might have been last night, watched the episode of All in the Family, Judging Books, I think is the title. Mike has a friend who presents as gay, and Archie is, you know, has all these lines about like fruitcake this and fairy this, and I think they use the faggot, the word faggot.
His pal Roger is as queer as a $4 bill, and he knows it.
That's not only cruel, Daddy, that's an outright lie.
You know something, Archie? Just because a guy is sensitive and he's an intellectual and he wears glasses, you make him out a queer.
I never said a guy who wears glasses is a queer. A guy who wears glasses is a four eyes. A guy who is a fag is a queer.
Well, and the thing that I like about that episode, which I'm not sure I've seen, but and also the homophobia that is prevalent throughout soap, because there are many characters who are not tolerant of Jody's lifestyle choices or whatever, however you want to call it, and he deals with those words constantly. He's called a fruit throughout the four seasons. The show is so clear on its allegiance to Jody, its loyalty to Jody. And the characters that matter love him so much that the people who use those words look like fools. The show sort of comes to its crest with Jody's storyline in season three. He's had sex with this woman. She has become pregnant. He proposes to her and she stands him up. She leaves him at the altar. But then she proves herself an unfit mother and abandons the child, and there's a huge custody battle, which is sort of the big emotional arc of season three, and all sorts of accusations are hurled, and lies are told in the course of the trial, in which Carol says that she came home to find him surrounded by men in this sort of orgy and the baby's there, and all complete lies. He's a totally responsible father. But the world of the show is absolutely certain that a single gay man is a totally fit candidate to be a father. Again, he's called all sorts of names in the course of the trial. He has this monologue where he absolutely loses it. He's just so tired of all the lies that are being told about him, and he just tells everyone off.
That's it.
Tell us, what are you doing?
What do these notes mean that we've been taking, huh? What good are they? What good are these law books, for God's sakes? Nobody tells the truth around here. I mean, am I going mad or what?
Restrain him, restrain him, please.
Why don't you just tar and feather me, for God's
sakes? Mr. Dallas, one more word out of you, and I am going to hold you in contempt.
Only one more word? All right, I have plenty of more words, Your Honor. How about mockery, huh? And disgrace, huh? Because I've been hearing these words ever since this travesty began. You're killing me here. You're ruining my life.
You know, sure, he spends a lot of time sleeping with women around this time, but he's still gay, and he still identifies as gay, and the whole point of the trial is that he is a gay man who wants to raise this child, and that the show can embrace that and embrace that so fully and not marginalize the story, not put it off to the side. It's a major, major story for that season, is really still incredible.
You know, it's so rare that we would see a character, like, when's the next time there's a character on television, a gay character, who actually has a love life? I think even on Will and Grace, it was like 4 or 5 seasons before Will even had a boyfriend.
Yeah, it took a while. I mean, was it Matt, the character on Melrose Place, who sort of had a love life? But that was also 90s. Like, I'd be hard-pressed to think of anyone in the 80s.
You know, I feel like the depictions, I can't remember who was saying this to me, but someone was saying that, like, of all the TV that they watch of them, of themselves, meaning of gay people in the 80s, they're like, I just felt like everyone was dying.
HIV and AIDS stole the narrative. There was no way around that. And that was going to have to find its artistic expression, just as the Holocaust stole the Jewish narrative for decades. When tragedies happen, it stops everything. It stops all progress, and artists have to grapple with it in some way. I have to assume that if AIDS had been discovered over the course of soap, they would have introduced it.
And it's really hard now to find soap. Like, I went looking for it online just to find some episodes, and I feel like either I have to buy physical discs, like some kind of Amish person.
I own the discs, but I'm a bit of a collector and, you know, have loaned them out to certain people trying to share the love, especially Golden Girls fans, because I want to make sure they understand I rented the first two seasons of Golden Girls. That was my exposure to it. I can't remember if it was at an actual video store or through Netflix, but yes, I had the physical discs.
So wait, you saw Golden Girls for the first time on disc when it was like...
I'm exactly the wrong age for the Golden Girls.
Ah.
The Golden Girls debuted in the fall of 1986, which was my first fall in college. So the last thing I was ever going to do in college was to sit around on a Saturday night watching older women on television. That would have meant social death. It wouldn't have been something I would have considered. And
right, well, you just described my college experience. So.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. But I was so nervous about college and socialization that I was never going to do that, and I was never going to find the people to do that with.
So were you out then?
No, not really. My coming out process lasted about 10 years. College was part of the process, but I was certainly not ready.
But at least Jody was there as one aspect of role modeling when you were doing it.
Jody was there as one positive voice, yes. And the family around Jody as well. So yes, there was that maybe quiet voice in the back of my head that it was all going to be okay.
You know, I think one thing that gave It Gets Better a lot of strength, this is something that Dan Savage has observed often, is that there was this ability to come into people's homes, to come into the homes of kids who needed to hear this message, you know, without having to go to these guardians of parents or priests or whatever, and talk directly to an audience that needed to hear it, which to an extent is what soap was doing as much as it could in the 70s. Like, I'm sure there are a lot of guardians who were like, you know, of course my 10-year-old kid is not going to watch soap, which was my experience even in the 90s. But you know, there you have like Jody on soap, or you have that one episode of All in the Family, or you have, I don't know, I'm sure there was gay characters on somewhere in the 80s.
There's a wonderful episode of MASH where a soldier is, I can't remember if he was actually gay or wanting to present as gay so that he could get out of the war.
Oh, he was a transvestite, wasn't he?
No, there's a different
one. Okay.
There's a cross-dressing character that pervades that's on throughout the show, but that was just comic relief. He was that was not really anything about sexuality or really about cross-dressing. I mean, it was just he was trying to be declared Section 8. But no, there was
slightly problematic.
Right. There was a rather serious episode where Frank Burns, the sort of villain of the camp, was going to I'm not remembering this well. He was threatening a dishonorable discharge to this guy, and Hawkeye and whoever his sidekick was in this particular season supported him. And it dealt with sexuality, and this was, you know, 1973, 75, somewhere around there.
I don't understand.
Private Weston is sick, diseased.
Well, if he should be quarantined, I must know immediately.
What should be quarantined is Frank's mind, if we can find something small enough to put it in.
Margaret, trust me. Perversion is one of the things we're fighting against.
You mean Private Weston? That nice boy?
Well, that's what I understand from some very reliable gossip.
There's a fantastic gay episode of Cheers. Also early in the show's run.
Oh, I totally forgot about that. Yeah, where they're worried that Cheers is going to become a gay bar.
Because there are two of the regulars that, I think it was Diane who knew that there were two regulars who were gay, and it causes this entire panic among the cast as to what it's going to mean. And again, like soap did so well, the main cast, their homophobia was the butt of the jokes, not the gay people. So they all looked like fools for being so intolerant. Mm-hmm. Rather than the gay people becoming stooges for who they were. The show is very, very smart in that way.
You always had more character.
Hey, listen, those guys are staying. Anyone else wants to leave, that's fine.
Okay, Sam, you know what kind of bar this could turn into?
It's not going to turn into the kind of bar that I have to throw people out of.
That was the noblest proposition you've ever dangled.
But it still very depicts, and I guess this is just the way that it really was, that the world of the gay and the world of the straight are two completely separate things. You can't have a bar that gay people go to that's also a straight bar. You can't have a straight bar that people you know.
No, that is true, and that's one of the things that was really nice about soap for me, was that it was a straight world, but Jody was in it, and he was part of it, and a major part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, unlike Will and Grace, which was essentially a gay show and a gay world.
That straight people sometimes walked into.
Sometimes, but, you know, the Grace and Megan Mullally's character, whose name eludes me right
Karen.
Now. Thank you. Sorry. Sorry to everyone. they were straight women, but really gay creations.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily want to use the onerous term fag hags, but...
Come in out.
You know, it would have been nice to have a show that was more integrated, and I think soap appealed to me on some level because, I mean, yes, Jody could have used a gay friend. That might have been nice. I mean, he did have a lesbian friend at one point, and she was a very interesting character. I like that they were together and represented as an integrated world rather than segregated.
So if people like soap, what would you recommend? Like, what are other shows that you think people should see?
I mean, my second favorite show, and I don't know how close they are except that they share an actor, is Sports Night. Which, you
very
know,
different.
Very different, but also did the comic and the serious very, very well. I mean, it was never as silly. Sports Night was never farcical. But still, just a beautiful character study, very funny and very touching. If I can say that soap is the show that resonates as my mother's show, Sports Night is the one that's my father's show.
Oh, really? In what way?
Well, Robert Guillaume had a stroke in the course of the show's filming, and he had a stroke only a few months after my father had a stroke. And watching Robert Guillaume come back on the show and be rehabilitated and be okay was a huge help to me to think that my father was going to be okay. There was something very therapeutic of watching Robert Guillaume go through the process so publicly that it gave me a great deal of hope about my father's prognosis, who lived many years after his stroke. So.
Oh. Well, thank you, Andrew, so much for joining us. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks to Andrew for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everybody who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get backer rewards like stickers in the mail and exclusive bonus videos. Check out my YouTube for deep dives into queer pop culture history at youtube.com/mattbaum and my newsletter at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.